Welcome to Breaking Doctrine, presented to you by the Combined Arms Doctrine Directorate at the Combined Arms Center at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. The views expressed here are those of the individual and do not represent the views of the Combined Arms Center, U.S. Army, or U.S. government.
Hello, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker. Today's episode is the second of two episodes focused on Russian threat doctrine. Just like last episode, the doctrinal foundation for this episode is the recently published ATP 7-100.1, Russian Tactics. We welcome back Mr. Jerry Leverich, the Senior Intelligence Analyst for the Training and Doctrine Command, or TRADOC, G2. Mr. Flip Boyer is also back on this episode and is an Intel Analyst with the TRADOC G2 here at Fort Leavenworth. Our CAD Director, Colonel Retired Rich Creed, also joins the conversation. Gentlemen, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Colonel Decker.
Thank you, ma'am.
Good to be here.
I'd really like to talk to kind of some basic building blocks of our army and how we fight, and the Russian army. So I'd like to compare and contrast Russian doctrine with U.S. doctrine, and first talking about the defense.
Yeah, so we published FM390 last year. It's our fundamental tactics field manual. It hadn't been revised in great detail for a while. One of the things that we realized as we started to focus on large-scale conventional conflict again, and we went back to look at our doctrine, was that we had, in many ways, in the U.S. Army, had this cult of the offense. And we actually had it written in some places that essentially, I'm oversimplifying, that the only reason U.S. Army forces ever defend is when you're preparing to attack. Which was kind of ridiculous. We had built this cult of the offense to the point, and it was really because our doctrine wasn't threat informed. It was really because our doctrine was all about our own capabilities and what we wanted to do, because we weren't envisioning fighting anybody that was seriously able to contest us. Because, again, large-scale conventional conflict was viewed as highly unlikely for almost 20 years. So we went back, and starting with the defense, we took a historical view of all the different reasons why you would defend. And there were some outside commentators, by the way, when this war started in 2022 in Ukraine, that we were out of position, that our operational concepts weren't accounting for the defense. And I think those criticisms were valid if all you did was look at the initial concept. But the manifestation of the concept in our doctrine really showed that we've reemphasized the defense. So while we continue to say that, you know, per Clausewitz, the offense is the decisive form of war, the defense is usually stronger, almost always. But it's the conduct of the defense by itself isn't going to determine the outcome of a campaign or a war. But the purpose of the defense is varied, and it's going to be contextual, right? It could be a counter to enemy action. We may be forced, for whatever reason, to have to retain decisive terrain or deny a geographical area to the enemy. We want to attrit or fix the enemy so that we can conduct offensive operations in a time or place of our choosing. And you can use the defense as an opportunity to create vulnerabilities with the enemy by attriting them. We want to defeat an enemy attack. We want to gain time. We do it as an economy of force. You can't attack everywhere all at once because that violates various principles of war. We account for three different types of defensive operations: and area defense, which I think in the 21st century is probably the most costly, because we've got this transparent battlefield now. And if you have to hold a piece of ground, the enemy knows where you are, and they can mass combat power against you. With persistent UAS and space capabilities, it's very hard to hide. So you got to dig in, and you got to protect yourself. Because if the enemy's coming for that piece of ground, they're going to mass fires on your location. And so things we used to do in the old days, digging in combat vehicles in battle positions and so forth, those types of things are important now because massed artillery can kill tanks. The mobile defense, you know, the best way to avoid those mass fires is to not be there when they come down. So you've got to be able to at least maintain some portion of your defensive force as a mobile reserve so that you can conduct counterattacks. And then this idea of retrograde, right? And this would probably be more applicable, say, in the early phases of the war in Ukraine. But if you're significantly outnumbered and you know, there's no reason for you to die in place against the superior force, then you've got to be able to conduct a retrograde defense, trade space for time, attrit the enemy as you fall back to more defensible positions, right? Or additional friendly forces can come up to lend support. So I think in summary, that's kind of where we're at. And we've got a much greater emphasis in doctrine on the defense than we did in the past. And again, I've talked about it from like a Ukraine campaign or Europe, you know, perspective. It would manifest itself differently in a theater like the Pacific.
Yeah. So you brought up a lot of really outstanding points there, sir. And there are a lot of similarities actually in the baseline thinking about defense between in U.S. military thought and Russian military thought when their officers are writing to each other and they're telling stories for development and planning. One of the important distinctions, I think, right off the bat is that the Russia really only recognizes two types of defense. And we've talked a lot about how military cultural experience in the U.S. has shaped how we see Russia. We haven't really talked on how it military culture shapes how Russia sees Russia. So for the Russian defense, they use a positional defense and a maneuver defense. And in their writing and in their doctrine, they preferred the maneuver defense. And they're thinking about the response to Barbarossa. They're thinking about the scorched earth tactics against Napoleon, the broad space of Russia, giving them time to set a positional defense and attrit and then launch a counterattack. The Russians tell themselves that the defense is the strongest form of warfare, but like the United States, they recognize that you can't win a war with defense alone. So the bottom line for any defense is to attrit and then launch a counterattack once attrition happens. Although Russians culturally and militarily prefer that maneuver defense, trading that space for time, for a bunch of reasons, they haven't been able to find themselves in a position to do that in Ukraine. And some of that is like grand strategic political. You have bled for this territory. You can't give it back to the Ukrainians. Some of it is exactly what you're talking about, the transparent battlefield. I don't think very many people in the U.S. defense thought environment or the Russian or even the Chinese could have imagined how much of a role this democratized use of drones was going to have. You know, the Russians in their pre-war doctrine viewed drones in a very similar way that we did. They were going to be used for target acquisition. You were going to have Air Force and echelons above combined arms army that maybe had a strike capability. And now it's a squad level asset. They're more common and less controlled than small mortars, like a 60-millimeter mortar. For a lot of reasons, Russia has devolved into the positional defense, the quote unquote serve weaken line, where the Ukrainian counteroffensive last summer foundered and failed. They executed that defense in a way that was outside of their doctrine as far as depths of minefields, as far as use of drones. You know, we saw the effect that that had on denying Ukraine the ability to get in there and breach the second and third set of defenses.
If we were talking defense, maybe we should compare and contrast the offense.
Sounds good.
So I talked about the once... you know, how much we emphasize the offense in U.S. doctrine for a long time. And we still do. We say the offense is the decisive form of war. And so why do you conduct an attack, offensive operations? We'll defeat enemy forces, destroy enemy forces, gain control of terrain, resources, or population centers. But more down to the tactical level, right? You want to secure decisive terrain. You want to deprive the enemy of something, right? Lines of communication, access to their own logistics, support of friendly populations, perhaps. You want to gain information. So we do say we fight for information on the ground, because there are things you can learn from the ground that you're not necessarily going to learn from the air or space. We can attack to fix an enemy force, right? So we want to force an enemy to fight us on our own terms in one location to create an advantage that you could exploit somewhere else. And we could counterattack, right? So we can attack to disrupt an enemy's attack. I think one thing that's different, and it's something, again, our Army is relearning in some ways as we focus on conventional warfare again, is the U.S. Army conducts operations as echelons of formations. We tend to view, particularly on the offense, small unit actions as being part of a larger whole. And so when we talk about battalions and brigades and divisions and corps, we're not talking about them in a conventional warfare standpoint as headquarters. We're talking about them as formations of formations. And so if we're conducting offensive operations, a brigade is part of a division conducting offensive operations, which, depending on the size of the campaign, could be part of a corps or even multiple corps. So each of those echelons of formations have responsibilities in terms of setting conditions and directing the activities of their subordinate formations. So it's, we view this as a, in our own way, a systems approach to conducting the offense, and that you're not assigning objectives to subordinate formations without doing something to ensure the success of those formations at the next higher echelon. So a division attack in the U.S. Army, you'll have a main effort brigade combat team, for example, but you have these supporting efforts that are doing things to set conditions to ensure that that initial main effort is successful. So I think that opens us up to a discussion of at least what we've seen, and maybe you can balance what we've seen against what the Russian doctrine says.
Okay. So early on in the war, the Russian doctrine was operating under a successive set of reforms that were driving them smaller, and they were expecting more what we would call the gray zone, conflict in competition, and they were kind of mirrored down to the battalion, our brigade combat team structure that we had optimized for kind of the global war on terror, smaller global wars. And you saw a lot of difficulty with that in the offensive for a bunch of reasons. So these junior officers were given more enablers than they were able to integrate into their plan. They weren't able to rely on the mass fires that a more senior Russian commander would be able to provide them. And their logistics were, you know, not to minimize the Russians, but I think we can all acknowledge one of their greatest weaknesses is their logistics capability there. It's a defensive rail-based logistics system that they put into an offensive move, like an offensive movement. They didn't prioritize moving the equipment. One of the examples, a concrete example, would be palletized loading systems. They don't have them. They're still moving wooden ammo crates by hand, off trains, two trucks.
I had no idea that their doctrine for logistics was to push a rail line out and that they weren't expecting to operate further than a certain radius from a railhead.
Yeah. Not only that, but for POL, they had pipeline troops.
Yeah.
They would create a pipeline from a POL holding facility and tap it out instead of sending fuelers or blivets, whatever. You know, and that's, I think that is a function of maybe how Russia wanted to use its resources to portray strength. You know, they've got the best tank. Maybe a fueler or a palletized loading system isn't as, quote unquote, excuse the analogy, as sexy as a T-90M, right? So no one in the world is bragging about their world-beating logistics truck. It's essentially what that's coming down to. So when we talk about Russia reverting to small unit stuff, so leading into the battalion tactical group conversation, for the most part, I expect that's going to go away in the future. They have acknowledged that the division is the warfighting echelon optimized against NATO.
Yeah, for conventional warfare.
Yeah, for conventional warfare. You know, you might see a BTG pulled out of Hyde to go support Syria operations.
Yeah, but small units.
Yeah, the small units. Anything in the new Leningrad or Moscow military district, for sure, is going to be division to combined arms army. And their plans will incorporate those mutual support. You know, they're bringing back the idea of artillery divisions that we saw in the Cold War that they kind of let go of. They didn't feel like they needed. So heavier long-ranged artillery and heavy mortar systems are being put back together under a centralized command to provide that mass of firepower.
Well, that command and control challenge, I mean, if you had a combined arms army, I think I read something in the first few months of the war where a combined arms army was trying to command and control 20-something battalion tactical groups. I mean, your span of control for any one person, you know, the literature, the psychological literature, leadership literature worldwide says 5 to 7 things is all, you know, an entity can control effectively. That's got to be part of it, right?
I think that is to get back to that span of control. So those battalions will return to their regimental commander who, in the pre-war doctrine, might have sat at home, trained some conscripts, had his retention officer go lean on some guys to sign a contract to go be replacements to fill losses, right? That regimental commander's having to go forward, that division commander, to the combined arms army to fix that span of control problem. So Russians are working on it. The reason you're seeing them divert to company or below actions is because if it masses or moves, it's dead.
Sure. Well, I would offer, in getting back to the offense on this also, is, you know, if you look at what happened in February 22 with, as you mentioned, Rich, you know, multiple battalions working for a combined arms army, you know, that's what they focused on. That was the Russian Army Unit of Action, the BTG. Now, the writing since then and subsequent mobilization of some divisions, is this was something the Russians got away from. So, you know, and the other point that I think we really got to remember also is by its composition, the Russian Army is actually more defensive-oriented than it is offensive, you know. A lot of the writings recognize and they aspire for the offense, but looking even at training exercises over the last years, they all start from the defense. And again, very pronounced in their offensive operations back in February, where the intent was to take Kiev, right, using battalions as a unit of action, but the integration, the combined arms aspect of this was I would offer, not well understood nor well rehearsed. You know, the idea was to push as much combat power to try and get into Kiev within 72 hours with as many battalions as you could. And it caused, you know, the logistics log jams that we saw on CNN and everything. The integration, the ability to bring during mobile offensive operations, the ability to synchronize fires with electronic warfare, with maneuver, it was hard.
I think to our point that we made is this is the Army of 2024 that is conducting operations is not the Army of 2022. And I think we need to pay more attention to the Army that we're observing right now.
Absolutely. And again, you know, how we're capturing those within those running estimates to actually articulate those trends, those changes, and how that Russian army is changing over time. You know, I highlight some basics. You know, at the beginning of this conflict, the Russians didn't have an attack UAV program. They had attack UAVs, but not a program. And then even in the beginning, when you saw the Turkish TB2s being used Those are no longer effective. Quadcopters, and then where we are today with first-person viewers, the integration and the change, the integration of Iranian UAVs, just a myriad or multiple points of evolution over the last 2.5 years to where we are today.
We've hinted at this already, and the UAS play a role in it, right? Because UAS can be a form of fires, whether it's loitering munitions or armed UAVs. But can you guys talk a little bit about Russian artillery and fires doctrine and how they view that from a doctrinal perspective? Because I think that's something that's maybe a little bit different than our Army that we need to be ready for.
So if I could set this up for you, Flip. So, we characterize, and we have for the longest time, the Russian Army as an artillery army with some tanks. If you look at the modernization that they've focused on, it's primarily been within the field of fires, vice the maneuver armor vehicle. If you look at the front end of this conflict, over 200 battalions of maneuver forces, an additional 50 battalions of artillery and fires capability that were brought to bear on this. And where they are today, the bringing back of artillery units, the heavy and the deep fire capabilities, things that they actually got rid of in their forces back in the 80s, things like the 2S4, the 2S7s. So absolutely fires focused. Flip, let me turn over to you and you can elaborate a little bit on that.
Absolutely, Jerry, and thank you for that setup. So Russians among themselves refer to artillery or fires as the god of war. It's second to their paratroops as a prestige arm, and it's their planning heavily predicates, as we talked about with that, the COFOMs, the application of a predetermined fires table, the use of fires to basically destroy or compel an enemy to withdraw, and then maneuvers almost an afterthought that follows up. So it's the opposite of how the United States Army might view it, where fires would support maneuver. I think that at the beginning of the Ukraine conflict, they got away from that doctrine a little bit, and you saw them pretty rapidly revert to it. In bringing older systems to bear, so you're seeing like D1 howitzers, D30s, coming online with new top-of-the-line systems or new top-of-the-line kit to aid in precision, or the fires targeting decision process, like the Strelitz that was supposed to integrate UAVs to their fire support and control vehicles, which didn't do as advertised at the start of the war, but I will say are getting better now. You're seeing a much better return on investment for precision. Russia's shaking them bums out.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've got the means for precision, right? Right down along the forward line of troops.
Absolutely. Yeah, so Russian fires doctrine, it's set. Your artillery commander and the staff planning will say, these are the COFOMs for a dug-in XYZ unit. We need to fire this many shells in this much terrain over this much time, or as close as we can get to that number. They will do that fires preparation on the tactical level and then conduct the almost battle drill tactical movements with maneuver that are required when you're lacking a platoon sergeant and your platoon leader is planning and executing training, so to speak.
One of the, artillery army with tanks, during this conflict, we've seen days where the Russians have expended 60,000 rounds in a single day. So the volume of fire is something that we need to go back and look at. And volume versus precision, with the first-person viewer UAVs, certainly give a precision unlike the artillery can do right now at a fraction of the cost. Now, with that argument, don't be confused and lead me to let you think that artillery is going to be replaced by UAVs. But I think what it really highlights is the balance of volume and precision that is so important on this battlefield.
Yeah, that makes sense, and that tracks certainly with what I've seen open source. I'd be interested in what you guys think in terms of, all right, so the Russian doctrine is inherently combined arms, right? But how do you see, and at what echelons do you really see a combined arms approach? What echelons do you think that they are starting to really apply a combined arms approach as opposed to just an infantry artillery type model?
Roger. So let's start with the defense, and let's be candid up front. In the areas that the Russians are, they've been there since 2014. The combined arms army or the army level is that integrator. It wasn't that successful in the beginning of the conflict. Probably over the last, I'd say, 3 or 4 months, we've seen a better integration of combined arms, probably at the combined arms army level right now. The intent and the understanding is to go to divisions. So as they bring those divisions online, working in that manner. But on the defense, the ability, you know, they've had some significant successes of late with, again, the ability to integrate electronic warfare with fires, with ISR, followed up with some limited objectives maneuvers, and it gets to the positional defense that Flip had mentioned. I think the big tell on their maturing of combined arms is going to be once we start seeing, or if we start to see, a better integration of air from the Russian side, and of course potentially from the Ukrainian portion. I would offer that one of their biggest challenges in their counteroffense last year was, you know, almost a single arm ground forces attempting to conduct that counteroffense. Flip, you got anything you wanted to expand on that?
As far as combined arms, you see a great deal of integration of electronic warfare, of fires, of maneuver, and then when you get down to maneuver, armor and mechanized infantry are able to work together. You see a thread of reconnaissance capability run throughout, which at the start of the war was very different than how it might look now. And we don't know if Russia's going to retain the democratized drones or go back to a more traditional drone structure after the war. You're really unusually for the Russians empowering junior commanders with those drones. So
if I could build in there to Flip's point, I think the excellence or the standard of excellence in combined arms, I would offer to your point, Rich, you know, bringing in the different arms, but the excellence is airspace management, you know, and the ability to open and close airspace with these Midrid and multiple UAVs, air defense systems, you know, controlling airspace for fires and things like that. And how we start to see the Russians evolve towards that and or the Ukrainians subject to the interdiction of air capability, I think is really going to speak volumes. This is hard, and the Russians are demonstrating it. The Ukrainians are demonstrated. Sometimes it's even harder with one arm behind your back. But combined arms on the modern battlefield and large-scale combat operation really puts demands, I think, on commanders and their ability to synchronize the different aspects of the arms and apply them to the battlefield.
Mr. Creed, what are the other things that you see in the U.S. Army combined arms that are strengths that maybe the Russians don't have?
Well, again, I want to be very careful about making any assumptions about, you know, whether we're better than anybody else at a certain thing since we're not actually fighting anybody. But I would tell you from a systematic, doctrinal and training approach, I think one of our advantages is this echelon approach to the conduct of operations, and that our corps and divisions operating as part of a larger joint force brings an extension of combined arms from the joint level all the way down to the lowest tactical level. Can we do all the things that we want to do as well as we want to do in the dirt? No, but we'll never be as good as we want to be. But we are re-emphasizing things in our training models now so that there is a higher echelon that is setting conditions and is creating a realistic set of circumstances for combat training center rotations.
And the combat training centers also provide experimentation, which in Russia and Ukraine, they're living it. We still have time to experiment.
That's true. But I think we need a sense of urgency, and we've talked about that in other podcasts. But it's, in fact, we talked about it with General Flynn. We don't know how much time we have. And so if we think, we shouldn't make any assumptions about that. And we talked about when you're on the defense, you never know how much time you have. I think in the real world, in the geostrategic competition, you don't know how much time you have either. So the sense of urgency is important. I think our Army has a sense of urgency in regard to understanding, hey, there are some things that we really got to get better at. And I think that's informing our modernization efforts. So I think all of those things taken together will give us some advantages in the future, but at least we're thinking about it. And we're not waiting till we get into a fight to have to figure this stuff out.
I think we certainly have an overmatched and a trained and ready force. Our investment in the individual soldier and our people are really an advantage for us.
The last building block I'd like to talk about today is the relationship between commanders and staffs. Flip, could you start us off with how Russia generally views how they do staff work?
So Russia is much more scientifically focused. I noticed earlier you had mentioned correlation of forces and means, right? So the basic way I explain COFOMs is the maximum that it's three attackers to dislodge a defender is a COFOMs type of formula. But the way Russian staffs are set up and the way they prioritize the use of that, they call it scientific substantiation,
right,
of warfare.
So they model it.
They model almost exclusively. So in a U.S. staff, you've got your commander, you've got your professional staff officers. A Russian staff at a brigade or a division or a combined arms army doesn't look like that. You'll have your deputy, you'll have your commander. Your commander will make the plan. Your deputy commander will be, say, it's a tank division. He'll be the senior tank officer. And then each subtype, the motorized rifles, the artillerymen, their senior commander will represent the staff. And they will use tools instead of our staff doing a IPB and then going through the MDMP process, a Russian staff, the commander will set a plan. These officers that are also going to be the commander of these forces in execution. So it's like in an American brigade, the brigade S2 also having to be the MICO commander.
So the planners and executors are the same.
Are the same. And they will use these COFOMS tables. They will use historical fires volume tables. They'll use all kinds of centralized staff decision aids. And instead of wargaming the plan, they mathematically verify the commander's assumptions. Then the order is issued, and then it goes out. So there's a lot of room for things to break in there. And then there's a lack of depth in Russian staffs for things like an S2 section. When your S2 is the commander of your reconnaissance troops, you don't have two or three trained analysts and a warrant officer tracking what might change in the enemy's plan, per se. If your fires planner on your staff is now commanding batteries, that presents a problem for flexibility. And one of the ways that you see this highlighted, I'll start off with one of the benefits this gives Russia is it cuts into their tooth-to-tail logistical thing that comes up, our logistical and support versus combat arms troop that comes up periodically. It makes that pool smaller, but it also puts a premium of pressure on the commander. And when you look at the Russian general officer, senior commander casualties, that's not a bug in the Russian system. That's a feature. So the commander's made the decision. The commander is going to move forward to where he assumes a decisive point is. And then a premium is going to be placed on his ability to do a personal reconnaissance, to personally observe and to make the decisions. And that puts him way further forward than an American counterpart or a NATO counterpart, and gives him a lot of risk. And that's why you kind of see those shockingly high numbers. It's not just great Ukrainian ISR and precision targeting.
You're right. Well, and then not having a professional NCO corps means that the risks that the seniors take are mirrored by the risks that company and field grade officers would be taking as well, right?
Absolutely. And then look at the pressure aside from all of the responsibility that an American platoon leader might have. They don't have an equivalent of a platoon sergeant. So that platoon leader, from the time you graduate the Russian military academy and finish the motor rifle lieutenant school, you are being trained to do this double duty. You're the platoon sergeant and the platoon leader. And then you move on up and you're in a battalion, you're a company commander. They have something that's roughly like manages personnel and details and reports to the commander, but doesn't come anywhere close to what a first sergeant would do in the U.S. construct. Not only are you doing kind of three-quarters of what a first sergeant does at the company commander level, but you're also now potentially, depending on your seniority, on the battalion staff.
Yeah, so that raises some interesting ideas, right? So, all right, I've got the plan. The tank division is going to conduct the attack. Everybody's committed to this plan, and they're going to stick with that plan like is absolutely, you know, right up to either success or failure. And so it seems to me that you could fall into a trap fighting Russians saying, okay, well, they're doing their thing, and they're going to keep doing this thing and keep doing this thing, and they're just going to keep coming. And that kind of opens you up to the deceptions, whereby you're like, okay, well, this is it. This is here they come. And all of a sudden, the larger plan had something else going on that would kind of catch you unaware. So you can't just assume that they're automatons that are sticking with the thing when there may be something else going on that you're not even tracking.
But Rich, I think what you've really highlighted there in Flip is, you know, the art and science of warfare. I would argue that the United States has relied more on the art, things like mission command, commander's intent, things like that. The Russians, because of the capabilities, the trained aspect of it, you know, certainly rely more on the science of warfare. and for all those reasons and examples that Flip had given there.
Yeah, but, you know, they have some advantages that would drive you towards this scientific approach when you have an emphasis on artillery, for one.
Yes.
An emphasis on EW, electromagnetic warfare, which is entirely scientific, right?
Right.
It's all stuff that can be calculated. And then I think we were talking defense. I think the engineering capabilities, you know, back when we were an army that were expecting to conduct a forward defense in Western Europe, we had our own science associated with building battle positions and blade time. I mean, you could calculate right now to within a few minutes how long it took you to dig in companies and battalion task forces and so forth on certain types of terrain, in certain types of weather and so forth. And we've gotten away from that, but they still have all those capabilities. I mean, they've got tremendous engineering and counter mobility, you know, capabilities, as well as artillery.
Absolutely, and I think that was demonstrated during the Ukrainian counteroffensive last year, and just how deep those minefields and those obstacles could be and how quickly they were able to put it in. It's because it's something that they continue while we might not have. The other thing, Rich, that you got at is the depth of the battlefield, and I would tell you that is one of the trends that we're seeing, both on the Russian side and the Ukrainians, you know, from defense, you know, extending the depth of the battlefield into the adversary's rear area. You see that with Ukraine going against the Black Sea Fleet. You see it from the Russians, you know, as they've improved some of their sensor to shooter and some of their reconnaissance capability to see deeper within the Ukrainian lines. So, you know, those aspects I think are really, really important. And while they might be set, how they evolve and the ability to understand, you know, 2.5 years of conflict here between Russia and Ukraine, what we're seeing today is significantly different than what we saw back when this began.
Thanks, gentlemen. Thanks for your time today. Do you have anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Hey, so if I could, just as a closeout and a paid advertisement, public service announcement, highly encourage listeners to of course, follow closely Rich Creed's doctrine, but also the Tradoc G2, as we've alluded to in so many ways during this conversation, have an online present with our Russia landing zone, where not only can you access the ATP itself, but a number of visualizations, interactive capabilities, as well as those running estimates, which I've alluded to, which I think are so important in understanding how that doctrine is actually evolving over time. And what are those trends and things that we're seeing from the conflict that would deviate from Russia or from Russian doctrine, and where they might be having successes or some places where they might be demonstrating some vulnerabilities.
Yep, no, that makes sense.
Well, I really enjoyed that conversation today.
Oh, absolutely.
Gentlemen, thanks again for spending time with us. Just like writing new doctrine is a team effort, breaking doctrine takes a team. Without the crew and special doctrine division here at CAD, we wouldn't be able to bring you this show. Our production is coordinated by Mr. Ted Crisco, and our editing and sound is provided by 29 Pixel Studios. Please don't forget to subscribe on YouTube, Apple, Audible, or Spotify podcasts, and follow us on social media at U.S. Army Doctrine to get updates on new podcasts, Doctrine Digest videos, and publications. Finally, the views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the official position of the United States Army, the U.S. Army Training and Doctrine Command, or the Combined Arms Center. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Lisa Becker, and this has been Breaking Doctrine.